few years and they were now engaged. They lived together a few streets away from me, just behind the Chateau Marmont. I spent a lot of time hanging out with them, cooking, barbecue at their house or mine, watching Justin record at the studio and hitting the nightclubs, the kind of passing-the-time L.A. stuff that you do when you're all in your mid-20s and life has not yet let you know how fast time actually passes. The house party is also an L.A. social event, and I went to one at Paris Hilton's house that summer, which turned out to be memorable and expensive. Paris lived in a 1920s Spanish-style casa, perched just above the Sunset Strip on North Kings Road and decorated in haute Paris style. Photos of her everywhere, a stripper pool in the living room, and of course, a swimming pool out back. When we arrived and were introduced, Paris couldn't believe how perfect my ass was. Yes, this is the alternate universe that LA can quickly become. She wanted to know how a man could have such a perfect ass without the aid of some sort of butt implant, which was then starting to gain popularity in LA. And yes, I was wearing clothes. So in the spirit of scientific inquiry, Paris wanted her assistant to slap my ass to see if it was real. I told her, sure, no problem. But in return, I would get to slap the female assistant's ass as well. It was a deal. So I let the assistant slap my ass. And before she could conclude that it was indeed as nature made it, I pulled my hand back, and instead of slapping the assistant's ass, I gave a healthy, firm, and flirtatious slap to Paris's ass. I didn't realize how fragile she was, and the slap, trust me, it was not anything close to an NHL love tap, kind of stunned her, and her eyes started to well up with tears. It was as if the upstart peasant had just struck the Queen of France. Her assistant open-hand slapped me across the face. I laughed this off and apologized to Paris when, suddenly, in mid-apology, I get slapped again by the guy she was dating at the time, who must have realized that he looked like a complete pussy and was drunk enough to have the balls to swat me. I remember laughing and thinking to myself that this had really gotten out of hand very quickly, all because of my hockey ass. Then suddenly, I hear a thump. Trace had jumped to my defense and thrown a right hand off the side of Paris's boyfriend's head and was now grimacing in pain. I knew where this was going next. So 17 hours later, I'm sitting in the hospital emergency room with Alicia when the doctor emerged to explain to us that the surgery on Trace's hand had gone well, and that the cast would need to be on for 6 weeks to let the screw in his thumb set properly. I really think that the $12,000 Alicia had spent on Trace's surgery was the beginning of the end of their relationship. I think it scared her to realize how all the financial responsibility was probably going to land on her, and that eventually being Justin Timberlake's best friend did not pay the bills, and that she wanted a guy who was more than the best pal of a celebrity. This is when Alicia and I started to fall in love without even really knowing it. Even so, I head to Memphis to hang out with Trace and his family on the 4th of July weekend. To see the heart of America on the most patriotic weekend of the year was a beautiful thing. As a professional athlete, you're sheltered from the middle class, even though almost all of us are from the middle class. We stop camping and become snobs. I mean, anything less than 4 stars in a hotel constitutes camping. Our reality becomes foggy from the fast ride we're on, and we don't remind ourselves where we came from or that we could be back there pretty damn soon if things don't work out. So a weekend like this was a welcome change from my high-speed LA life. We spent some time at Justin Timberlake's family home, and seeing one of the biggest stars in the world being so comfortable in his small town, dancing around a fire and eating barbecue with his family and best friend, is something I'll never forget. He lived on planet Earth, and his family is the reason why. But it does bother me to think about Trace opening up his family and friends to me, knowing in my heart what was coming next. Part of the reason why Alicia and I were coming together, aside from our strong physical attraction, was that we came from the same place. It's funny, I used to avoid Canadian women, and now here I am in LA, all excited that my girlfriend knows about the tragically hip and coffee crisp. It was kind of like having a secret language. And the fact that she was beautiful and smart and had a great sense of humor and loved hockey didn't hurt either. Alicia broke off her engagement to Trey soon after the punch at Paris Hilton's house, and he moved out, but nothing physical had happened between us. I was stopping by her house more than usual, though, and we had a group of friends who would hang out, have dinner, watch Who Wants to Be a Millionaire on TV, or go see a movie. I enjoyed the group, but I wanted to be alone with Alicia, and it was obvious to both of us what was going on. We had our first kiss on the walkway in front of her house, and when we looked at each other after the kiss, she laughed and said, "They're going to have a field day with this." We both knew that. But forward was the only direction that we both wanted to go. On July 22, 2005, the NHL lockout officially ended after we voted pretty much overwhelmingly to accept what the league was going to give us. I voted to end it, because at that point, we were all just waiting for the league to make us an offer so we could get back to work. But it had all come at a cost. The lockout itself cost the league about $2 billion in lost revenue. Players who were under multi-year contracts before the lockout had their salaries rolled back 24%, which was a major hurt. NHL teams could each spend $21 million to $39 million on players the following season, which made the NHLPA's rejection in February of the league's offer of a $42.5 million salary cap an offer that would have saved the season even more painful. Our new contract also guaranteed we would receive 54% of the league's revenue, but in the past, we got closer to 75%. I remember reading about the settlement, and a quote from a labor lawyer in New York who'd worked for the NFL and NBA unions stuck with me. He called our deal the largest setback for players that I've seen in collective bargaining. It had been a hard time not just for us, but for people who worked in arenas at our games both off and on the ice. Referee Bill McCreary, who'd put me in the penalty box a few times, installed kitchen cabinets to pay the bills during the lockout. Stéphane Prouveau, a linesman who'd officiated more than 700 NHL games, was painting houses for $10 an hour during the months when we should have been playing for the Stanley Cup. And as I predicted, there were older guys who would hang them up, and some of them were Hall of Famers. Scott Stevens, Ron Francis, Al MacInnis, Mark Messier, Adam Oates, Igor Larionov, Steve Thomas, and Felix Potvin all retired. Not in a blaze of glory as they should have done, but in a ditch of greed dug by owners and by the NHL and by some of us. As for Chelly, he worked even harder to expose all the backroom dealing that had gone on during the lockout. He was tireless. The rest of us were just tired. Before the regular season even started, I was already in trouble. We were playing an exhibition game against Phoenix at the Staples Center, and it's early in the second period. My teammate Jeremy Roenick takes a pass from Alex Frolov when the Coyotes' Dennis Gauthier slams Roenick into the boards so hard he has to leave the game with a concussion. It was at least the 10th concussion that Roenick has suffered, and we all know the problems that head injuries can cause you down the road. I think it indicates the state of our game, the lack of respect, especially in the preseason, Roenick said at the time. It is uncalled for. It is ridiculous. It is one of the reasons our game isn't as good as it once was. So when I was on TSN, one of Canada's sports networks, a couple of days later, I spoke up on behalf of my teammate, and I said this. I think it was typical of most French guys in our league with a visor on, running around and playing tough and not backing anything up. The problem was the word French. It was as if I'd insulted every single soul in the great province of Quebec. What all I really meant was that if you're wearing a visor, you're sending a signal that you're not ready to fight, which you're going to be invited to do if you crush a star like Roenick. And back then, it was mostly French Canadians and Europeans wearing visors. Maybe I could have put it better, but the NHL's vice president of hockey operations, Colin Campbell, called me up and said, "Listen, we know how some of these guys are, but you can't say it, Sean. You can't always say what you're thinking." So I said, "Sorry, but I still think that if you wear a visor and don't fight, then you don't run, guys. A couple of months later, I was in trouble again. We were playing in Phoenix, and I collided with a coyote and went down. There was no penalty called on either of us, but a day later, the NHL fined me $1,000 for diving. Basically, someone in the league offices was calling me a liar and a faker. Now, guys will sometimes dive, but hockey players and fans take pride in our game's difference from soccer. The joke is soccer players pretend they're hurt, and hockey players pretend they're not. I'm pissed off if I get a penalty, but I'm even more pissed off if I get a penalty long after the game is over. And I let my feelings be known to an LA Times reporter. For that, Colin Campbell fined me another $1,000 for my complete lack of respect for all those associated with our game. I was even more annoyed when I found out I couldn't appeal this injustice, thanks to the work of our brain trust at the NHLPA and further eroding our rights in the new CBA. It was clear to me that the NHL had a bullseye on my back and would use this lack of respect argument to get me somehow, somewhere. What I didn't respect was having someone watching me on a TV thousands of miles away tell me I'd taken a dive. Things happen fast in hockey, and if a guy trips you or hooks you or elbows you in the head, it's quite likely that you'll go down. And sure, part of my game is to suck the other team into penalties, and so I have gone down a little quickly on occasion. But it's such a subjective penalty, and this time I didn't dive. For the league to get inside your head and say that no, you really embellish the offense is a classic blame the victim strategy. I know there are certain guys I have to fight in the NHL and that there are certain times when I have to fight them. It's November 2nd and we're playing in Dallas and I make another one of those calculated decisions to fight tonight. Steve Ott is a player similar to myself, a guy who came out of the OHL a couple of years after me. But the difference is that he was chosen 25th overall in the NHL entry draft. He can play and he can put the puck in the net, but he's got a nasty streak. And I'd say he's the third most hated man in the NHL after Gary Bettman and me. Ott would take a baseball swing two-hander with the intent of breaking your wrist, for example. I knew this fight would happen the moment I saw the schedule, and I also knew that this would be a strategic fight where I would try and get the first punch in. I start the game well, getting a goal early in the first. Halfway through the third, we're up 6-2 when the puck goes over the glass and I give Stu Barnes a little shove after the whistle. Right on cue, Ott comes over and we're off. We wrestle a bit to get loose and I throw one. Ott throws one back and misses. We dance like this for a bit and my helmet comes off. And then I get Ott's helmet off and land a couple more. Then the linesmen come in and break us up. Hockey players try to get helmets off so we don't hurt our hands punching a helmet. But I think punching a head hurts more than hitting a helmet. The moment those gloves hit the ice, everything goes quiet and everything slows down. You don't think about anything else during those 10, 20, 30, 40 seconds. Everything surrounding you and your opponent goes blurry and it's completely silent until the moment you hit the ice. I have a move where I roll my head under my opponent's right arm, which confuses him and gives me a different angle to throw my rights from. Hockey fights are as strategic as a chess match. Each time you grab your opponent's jersey, you're setting up the next punch. Of course, he's trying to do the same thing, so I always try to limit my opponent's ability to hit me by ducking and weaving and bobbing back as he throws haymakers. I wait for an opening and then I strike. You can win a hockey fight with one punch, and sometimes that punch doesn't KO your opponent, but it knocks him off balance enough that you can throw the punch that knocks him to the ice, and then you follow on top of him for the win. A magical adrenaline rush fuels it all, and with 20,000 people cheering for you, it's that roar that lifts you up to the rafters. And then you are slammed down by exhaustion. I've had some fights where it took an hour for my legs to stop shaking and my heart rate to return to something approaching normal. Although I was far from a heavyweight, I understand how hard that job is on those guys. When you look at the schedule in September and know that in November, you have 8 games where you're going to fight another man and that he could end your career with one punch, that is the definition of stress. We have no idea how hard that job is. And I've chosen to do it from time to time, but still I stand in amazement at the guys who have to do it to stay in the league. On December 5th, 2005, the Kings land in Toronto. Alicia has arrived from Montreal, where she's been visiting her parents for a few days, and she'll come to the Kings-Leafs game the next night. She snuck into the team hotel, though it wasn't a stealth mission because it was freezing cold and she was bundled up, so no one recognized her. I made sure to book a room of my own. At this point in our relationship, we're under deep cover. Maybe just two of our mutual friends know what's going on between us. We started as friends, but now it's obvious that we're falling in love, and we probably have been for months, even though nothing physical went on between us until quite a while after she'd called off her engagement. Before we descend to the freezing streets of Toronto, where all the eyes of the city will be upon us, this is the hockey hotbed of the world, after all. I need to make a phone call to Trace. I need to tell him what's going on before he sees it online. This is not an easy call to make, and although there's something very serious happening between myself and E, I do feel like my character is about to take a hit. Trace has been my friend for more than a year, and we've spent a lot of time together, both he and I, as well as the three of us. I call Trace's cell phone and he answers. He's in Memphis. Trace and Alicia had split up 2 months earlier, so he's gone home to spend some time with his family and his best friend, Justin Timberlake. I tell Trace that I'm in Toronto with Alicia and that we're together. I tell him I've broken the code between two men and try to justify it by saying it was something I couldn't control. Part of this is true, but I'm a big boy and I can control pretty much every decision in my life. I just knew I wanted to be with Alicia. Trace asks to speak with Alicia and tells her she's broken his heart and that he knew this was going to happen between her and me. Then he hangs up. I didn't steal her away from him. She realized that Trace was not the man she wanted to marry, and I happened to be there. I was prospective, but I wanted to be much more than that, and she wanted me to be too. The heaviness of that call is numbed by the adrenaline we feel being with each other, and we're about to step out to show anyone who cares that we're together. Alicia is a rarity in Canada, a successful working actress. She was on 24, one of the biggest shows in TV history, and I'm going to be on Hockey Night in Canada the next night. People will notice. And little did I know then how much they would care. After our 2-1 win against the Leafs, I'm doing the media scrum, and for the first time, the media asks me a question about my love life. So I give the Hollywood answer and say, guys, you know I don't talk about that. But when I meet E in a quiet corner near the team bus waiting to take me to the Kings 747, ready to whisk me home to LA for a few days rest between gigs, I feel like a fucking rock star. I know the increased attention that I'm getting both on and off the ice bothers my teammates. I know some of my teammates wonder why this guy who wasn't drafted and hasn't scored 20 goals is getting so much love. No one says this to my face, but Luke Robitaille gently lets it be known when he's checking in with me, which he's done since I first joined the team. When I got traded to LA, he was one of the first guys to call me and tell me how much I was going to enjoy the city. He'd like to send me texts and he'd call me up to make sure I was okay. Now he was telling me that I had to manage my growing celebrity so that it wasn't too much too soon. He'd been teammates with our GM, Dave Taylor, and said that Taylor didn't like it when you went after attention aggressively. You had to be slow about it. I listen to Luke. He's friendly and supportive. But behind his words, I hear the voices of my teammates saying, I'm a better player than this guy Avery, so why the fuck is he getting this attention? I never once walked into a dressing room carrying a magazine with my picture in it, or flaunting some magazine that had my girlfriend on the cover. But if the guys are jealous of the attention I'm getting, what am I supposed to do? Not date Alicia? I play my game on the ice just like I always have, but the temperature of the room has changed, and I know that it's going to get even colder. Alicia was proud of me, though. And she was the warmth countering the chill that was blowing my way because of our relationship. She was very funny and she could take a joke, and she also preferred the company of guys to women. Alicia was like one of the guys in many ways. She could sit down and polish off a bottle of Jack Daniels on her own. There were times when I got up to go to practice, and Alicia was still up and hanging out with our friends whom I'd said goodnight to a few hours earlier. She was a female Chelly in a way. I loved it. She also understood hockey because she was a fan. After a tough game when I might not have played my best, she'd say to me, "I'll see you at home." She knew that I didn't want to talk about it in the car. When I started dating Alicia, she'd recently made a decision to focus on her movie career and to put television, which had catapulted her into a much higher level of fame than she'd ever known, on the back burner. I wish I'd talked to her more about acting. I would do line readings with her, but I didn't understand any of it. I was so focused on my own work that I didn't pay enough attention to hers. Alicia had an amazing work ethic. When she was doing 24, she was up at 4:30 a.m. She was always prepared for auditions and always worked on being an actor and getting better at it. I remember going to the 24 Christmas party and meeting Kiefer Sutherland. He played hockey in an old-timers league and was a fan, but he was the type of guy who didn't want to bother me by talking about work in the same way that he didn't want me asking him about Jack Bauer. When he buckled up to have a good time, that's what he wanted to do, and he was good at it. Usually my friend Lawrence Longo and Alicia would go to games together. He'd pick her up and drive her since she liked to have a drink before the game. She'd start to get nervous in the afternoon, a few hours before puck drop. At this point in my career, my nerves are more excitement than fear, because we haven't really done anything in LA, so there's not a lot of pressure on us. There were so many times when I'd come out after a game and Alicia would be pissed off, and I'd ask Lawrence, "What happened?" And he'd tell me, "She got into it with an opposing fan." They had to leave a game in Anaheim once after she got into it with some Ducks fans. She was defending me and the team, and after she'd had a couple of beers, she was 6 feet tall with the mouth of a trucker, and Lawrence decided for their mutual well-being, they should escape. I have to say, any woman who is willing to stand up for Sean Avery in a hockey rink has more backbone than most guys I've played with. By the end of the season, and it's a better season than the previous one, we're still in the playoff hunt, but on a skid. It's March 24th, 2006, and we've lost 4 of our last 5 games. Vancouver, Edmonton, and Colorado are all swimming around the same playoff spot, and we were shut out by Colorado 5-0 in our last game. The tension in our dressing room is high, but tension like this in an NHL dressing room is sometimes the best remedy for a slump. This combination of a slump and the looming playoffs means it's the one time in the year where teammates fight in practice. This is what always happens, and the team goes on to win the next game. But even though guys fight and we're on our way to working things out, our coach, Andy Murray, decides to impose a new motivational tool in practice. So when I screw up a drill, he decides the only way to rally me and the Los Angeles Kings is to make us do some push-ups. I'm stunned. Has Andy been taking coaching lessons from some B-movie about motivating a slacker high school football team? My teammates are stunned as well. I mean, push-ups? When we're trying to make the playoffs? How about helping us understand the drill we screwed up? But as I said earlier, Andy didn't play hockey, so how could he really coach it? I was not happy about this stunt he just pulled, and I knew I wasn't alone. The guys had given up on Andy. Our game the next day is against Nashville, who are one of the best teams in the NHL this season, and who are definitely going to make the playoffs. I'm pissed off from the moment I wake up and want to shove it up Andy's ass in tonight's game. Just how would I do this, though? It's late in the third period, and we're leading Nashville 5-4. It's been a wild game. I start out with the puck on our end and gather speed through the middle. I go wide on the D-man, and at the top of the circle, I take a shot that somehow ends up back on my stick, and I'm now below the goal line. I unleash a hard snapshot at Thomas Vokoun, the Nashville goalie, just trying to hit him in the off chance I can bank it in behind him, and it works. I skate to the corner. Mike Camilleri skates over to give me the celebratory hug, but he must sense that I'm going to do something different because he backs off. In one swift motion, I'm down on the ice, banging out 3 push-ups. Nobody in the Staples Center knows why I'm doing this except the guys who'd been at practice the day before. They know it was a huge fuck you to Andy, and Andy knows it too. But I never learn what he thinks of it, because the next day he gets fired. Although I didn't love Andy Murray and had precious little respect for his coaching ability, I was in the awkward position of also appreciating his assessment of me. He must think I'm valuable to the team because he has me in the lineup. And all you can ask as a player is to get a shot. Then you have no excuses. I mean, how would I coach me? If I had a guy who worked hard all the time and expected his teammates to do the same and called them out when they didn't, and also got in trouble with the league for shit he said and did, would I try to change him? I like to think I'd channel what was best about his game into a force that would help the team. And I would do it with a light touch, because guys like me are always hardest on ourselves and don't need a coach to keep pointing it out. Guys like me need a coach who will teach us stuff that makes us better players. And Andy Murray was not that guy. So while I'm confident in my ability to keep bringing value to my team, I'm also nervous that the new guy may not like me. But then everyone is feeling this because who fires a coach this late in the season when you have a shot at the playoffs? I mean, you might think I'm always blaming the coaches, but this time management went even further. I know now that LA's ownership must have told Dave Taylor he could fire Andy, but only if he hired an interim coach and didn't sign him beyond the end of this season. Because if the Kings didn't make the playoffs, there would be a house cleaning in management and maybe in the dressing room too. Dave Taylor obviously didn't have many options then because what kind of coach would take an 11-game tryout on a team that had plunged so far without a contract for the following year? A coach with no job and no leverage. That's who. John Torchetti was from Boston, and to be fair to the man, he played in the Quebec Major Junior Hockey League and toughed out a few seasons as a winger in the minor pros. He'd also been behind an NHL bench as an assistant coach with Tampa Bay and Florida. And 2 seasons earlier, he was a mid-season, or late season, just 27 games left, head coach replacement in Florida. They did not make the playoffs. He had been behind the taxi wheel during the lockout, yet another example of what guys had to do to get by. He was hungry, and he was likely very inexpensive, and he also had NHL experience. He was the perfect sacrificial lamb for the King's brain trust. We'd be a Disney movie if Torchetti's inspired leadership had us raising the Stanley Cup. I like John. I mean, he was doing his best, considering the circumstances. And even though we were all relieved by the fact that he was an interim coach and unlikely to come down hard on us or mess with the lineup, we also knew that we could be an interim team if we didn't step up and give the playoffs our best shot. Torchetti had to inherit Andy Murray's assistant coaches, Mark Hardy and John Van Boxmeer, and it turned out that it would be the assistants who would be the trouble. During practice before our third to last game, when we still had a mathematical shot at the postseason, I got into a fuck you match with Mark Hardy. Honestly, I don't even remember what happened. Even though all the reports had said that I refused to participate in a drill, which is complete bullshit. Everyone was miserable, and tension was high, and everyone was stressed to the max. So I might have questioned the point of whatever drill Hardy thought we needed to do with 3 games left in the season, games that we had to win. Hardy kicked me off the ice and the next morning told me that I wouldn't play the final 3 games of the season. I wasn't being suspended by the team or the league. I just wasn't playing. I was scratched. Mark Hardy had found his scapegoat, and so I sat in the stands for the game we had to win against Phoenix. We rose to the occasion by losing 3-0. We were out of the playoffs. The old boys club in the NHL is filled with yes men, and if you're deemed an old boy, it's assumed you're an upstanding citizen, no questions asked, until you say something that the old boys don't like, or you do something they can't sweep under the rug. The latter is what happened to Hardy. Years after our dust-up, he apparently got hammered in Washington, D.C., where he was staying in a hotel with his family. and stumbled back to the hotel and crawled into bed with his 21-year-old daughter. Then he did something that she obviously did not want to happen, so she called the police and had her father arrested. He was charged with sexually assaulting his daughter, although the charge was later dropped for want of prosecution. And Mark Hardy has a better reputation than I do? The Kings removed Dave Taylor as GM of the team in April, shortly after our death spiral, and, as pro hockey is so good at doing, reassigned him to another position within the organization. A bunch of scouts and player personnel were also fired or reassigned. I'm not going to stress about the new GM and who he's going to hire as the new coach, because I had a strong season and had statistically improved from the previous season. Nevertheless, the new GM, Dean Lombardi, summons me to a meeting in his office in May. Lombardi played college hockey, then he went to law school, became a player agent, and crossed the street into management when he joined Minnesota as an assistant GM in 1988. He went on to do some good things as GM in San Jose, and now he was here, looking at me like I'm an interesting experiment. Dean is a straight-talking guy who respects his players. He understands that each one of them is different, and that part of a great team are the personalities that make up its DNA. I like him. We talk about how I'm an effective player, and how his expectations for my play this season build on what I've done so far on the ice. His concerns are all directed at my behavior off the ice, which he has not seen, but he thinks if I correct my off-ice adventures, then I'll also be more controlled on the ice. He doesn't cite anything specific, and I listen to him in surprise. I've never had a DUI. I've never been late for a game or practice. And when I did get arrested for playing music too loud, the charges were dropped. Even so, people in the hockey world who've never met me think I'm a major problem once I'm let loose on the public. Realizing that Dean thinks I might be a psycho killer about to attack LA, I ask him to please do me a favor and check in with some of my friends, Maddie Nordstrom or Luke Robitaille or Jeremy Roenick, for a character reference. I know they'll speak well of me, or at least fairly well, because they don't feel threatened or have any jealousy toward me. Dean listens and then tells me that I'm on a short leash. I always love it when my boss compares me to a dog, and that he won't hesitate to trade me if I'm not fitting in with his team. And then even though he's a man that stays out of the spotlight, he decides to inform our friends in the media that he's putting me on double secret probation. You might recall another Dean, Dean Werner Wormer in the film Animal House, talking about double secret probation, which is what he put the Delta Tau Chi fraternity on when regular probation didn't cut it. Years later, Dean Lombardi would have a player accused of smuggling drugs across the Canadian border, and a player accused of beating his wife, and another player caught trying to bring ecstasy and cocaine into a Vegas pool party. All three players would be charged or suspended or both within the year. Yet, it was me who earned double secret probation. I guess it worked so well with me that he figured he never needed to do it again. That summer, there was a new music festival happening in George, Washington. Yes, that's a real place, about 150 miles southeast of Seattle. So Alicia and I and Lawrence Longo rented a 44-foot RV, the largest you can rent with a regular driver's license, and loaded it with supplies for the 16-hour drive to the Gorge in George. Lawrence's girlfriend Kim came with us. We pile into the RV and I put that baby in drive, and using old school road maps, which cover the front dashboard, we head down Sunset Boulevard to Highway 1 and then head north on the scenic route, which will take us along the Pacific coast and through the redwood forests into Washington State. The landscape is stunning, with trees stretching into the heavens like nature's skyscrapers and the blue Pacific surf crashing against the rocks below. I've never been to this part of the world before, and now I see why people who come from here are so hard to impress when they arrive in parts of the world less blessed by nature. Yet while the forests of Oregon are indeed awesome to behold, The drive up a two-lane mountain road is not easy for a 44-foot RV to navigate, and the drive back down is even harder. But Alicia is game for anything, and when we stop, she is the first one to get out of the motorhome and fill it up with gas and pull out her own credit card. She's proud of being self-sufficient, and I'm proud of her generous attitude toward everyone and everything. There's nothing like traveling on windy, narrow roads in a rented RV to put someone's character into perspective. And I realize just how fine a person Alicia is and how lucky I am. When Lawrence takes over his share of the driving, Alicia and I try to get some sleep in the back bedroom of the massive RV. Now, I haven't talked about my real addiction. Other than my sweet tooth, I'm addicted to cleaning. I clean my sneakers after I wear them outside. I change the laces in my skates before a hockey game. I wash the dishes before everyone is even done with dinner, and I vacuum the apartment 2 or 3 times a day. Lawrence, on the other hand, is a tornado, leaving a trail of destruction in his wake. So I have to give the RV a quick clean before I can possibly expect Alicia and myself to have any chance of falling asleep. Finally, we lie down and we're just drifting off when the RV swerves to the right and taps the guardrail. The roads are tight, so I let this slide. Then we tap another guardrail, but it's a bit bigger tap this time. Alicia gives me the look to go have a chat with Lawrence and make sure he's concentrating. When I get to the front, Lawrence is in the driver's seat, smoking a joint with a bottle of wine nearby while Kim is trying to give him a blowjob. If he wasn't already swerving all over the road, and she could actually do the job at hand, pardon the pun, I'm afraid he would have taken the RV over the edge, and it would have been goodbye to all of us. But my intervention worked. We made it to George Washington in time to see the tragically hip, and we got really lucky at this incredible 5-star hotel directly next door. He was tough, and she could have roughed it, but we would have been crazy not to take this room. And I don't think we could have lasted 3 minutes, let alone 3 days, bunking in an RV with Lawrence Longo. Chapter 14. From L.A. to New York. As we start the 2006-2007 season, we get a new coach in Los Angeles. And it's like getting a new boss anywhere. The first thing that comes to mind is the question, are they going to like me? There's always the chance that a new guy will want a clean house. And if he cleans me out, it won't be because I didn't give Mark Crawford my very best effort. Everyone calls him Crow. He looks a bit like one, with intense eyes and perfectly gelled hair. And in profile, he has a kind of cunning crow-like beak. He's played for the Vancouver Canucks, he's done a lot of time in the minors, and he won a Stanley Cup as head coach in Colorado. Though, given the all-star lineup on the bench, I think Lawrence Longo could have coached that team to a cup, even while he was in full RV relaxed mode. Crow last coached the Vancouver Canucks, but got fired after the team never made it past the second round of the playoffs in his 6 seasons with them. In fact, they never made it past the first round 3 times and never made the playoffs at all 2 times under Crow. In the world of pro sport recycling, it was Crawford's lone Stanley Cup in 1996 that made him our bench boss a decade later. Crow has a reputation as being a bit of a crazy man. He was the coach for Vancouver when Todd Bertuzzi sucker-punched Steve Moore, allegedly at Crawford's command. And as I get to know Crow, I can absolutely believe he told Bertuzzi to go take Moore's head off as payback for Moore's hit on the Canucks captain, Marcus Naslin, a few games earlier. So Bertuzzi attacks Moore in a game in March 2004 and winds up ending Moore's career. Moore sued Bertuzzi for $68 million in damages. The suit was settled in 2014. Crawford's Vancouver reputation doesn't do him justice. He really is nuts. He loses his shit on the bench like no other coach I have ever seen. He kicks guys in the back when they're on the bench and he's unhappy with them. And he grabs guys' jerseys and pulls them inches from his face while he's screaming with ferocity. I mean, the veins are popping out of his neck. This is new to most of us. Anytime Andy Murray tried to yell like that, you'd be tapping the leg of the guy beside you in a, hey, don't miss this pussy trying to actually scare us kind of way. Andy Murray was a joke when it came to the intimidation department. Mark Crawford scares the shit out of me at times. We're 6 games into my new season with Mark Crawford, and things are going great. I have 1 goal and 3 assists, and I'm playing more than 15 minutes a night. Before tonight's game against Detroit, I spent some time sitting on our bench at the Staples Center, looking at the fresh ice and the empty stands, and I have Steve Yzerman's words running through my head about just shutting up and playing hockey. In every game I've played against Detroit since I was traded to LA, I've been too pumped up and not focused on the little things. I was more focused on taking a run at Chelly or beating Draper in faceoffs. Tonight, though, I settle in and I play a focused game. We lose 3-1, but I score our only goal. As the season wore on, we lost more than we won. Crow's constant screaming at us created a different kind of toxic environment from the one Andy Murray had created. Murray was the high school math teacher trying to bombard us with information he didn't understand, while Crawford was the wild-eyed gym teacher who'd once heard the roar of the crowd and figured if he roared loud enough at us, then we'd respond. There was one time I left him speechless, though, and that was during a practice. Halfway through, he's screaming at us about this drill we'd fucked up. I'm not paying attention to his explanation because I can't listen to him anymore. We were doing a breakout drill where you go into the opposing zone at speed and then come back out a few times, and on the last breakout, you dump the puck in. I had the puck, and because I hadn't been listening, I dumped it in too early, right in the corner of the rink where Crawford was standing, watching the drill. He didn't see the puck coming, and I watched it heading toward him in slow motion. It smacked him right on the forehead. It didn't knock him out, but it knocked him down. His stick and gloves went flying, and there was blood flowing from his head onto the ice. He knew it was me because the last thing he saw was the puck on my stick. He couldn't kick me off the ice because the medics were hauling him off it to sew him up. But he gave me the death stare as he skated off. And I knew that one way or another, I wasn't going to be here long. I'm also getting tired of Los Angeles. I mean, there are only so many days at the beach. Yes, I did love the city, but as that season wore on, I wasn't excited by its possibilities. I was bored by the routine of the place, the endless sunshine, the same talk in the locker room of grabbing beers at Harry O's after the game, or buying a new boat for the cottage in Muskoka, or the latest thing the wife, girlfriend, mistress did with your money that is both a boast and a gripe and is always tedious. Still, by the All-Star break at the end of January 2007, everything is going well with my season. I'm playing more than 15 minutes a night under the lash of Mark Crawford, and he pretty much leaves me alone. The team, though, is awful. We won 16 games so far and lost 34. We're in 29th place out of 30 teams and last in the Western Division. Fuck me. Andy Murray had us playing better than Stanley Cup-winning genius Mark Crawford. It's depressing to be playing well and losing so much. Brendan Shanahan has signed with the New York Rangers and loves it. The team and the city have been a rebirth for him. After 19 years in the NHL, he says he feels alive playing before a true hockey crowd at Madison Square Garden. And of course, there's New York City awaiting you after the game. Shanny is meant to play for the Rangers. He looks so good in the red, white, and blue jersey, Clark Kent, with a little more edge. Shanny is like the woman who walks into a room and instantly gets everyone's attention. He drinks the best wine and wears the best suits and can cross his legs in a way that makes him look even smarter and richer than he is. After our final game before the All-Star break, a 3-2 loss to Phoenix, I hustle to LAX for my red-eye flight to New York. I'm going to visit Alicia, who is in New York shooting a movie called My Sassy Girl, but I'm also going to see Shanny. The Rangers aren't playing well this year either, and because of the season I'm having, I know Shanny is confident in planting a seed with Glenn Sather about making a trade for me. Alicia was tired from long days of shooting, so On my first night in town, I meet up with Shanny for dinner at Dos Caminos in the West Village. He was with a few guys from the team, and it was awkward, as it almost felt like an audition. My reputation with the rest of the league at the time was not very good. So even though the legend that is Shanahan is vouching for me, it's almost like I still need to be vetted by the mob. "Just keep it simple, Sean," Shanny told me. "Drink a beer or two, talk about nothing, laugh at the right time, and the guys will be able to say you're normal. That's all we want." Shanny's strategy was to softly introduce me to some of the players on the team, so that when he broached the topic with Sather or with Coach Tom Rennie, he could say, "Some of the guys met him the other night and thought he was a good guy." In truth, the guys weren't tough on me at all. There were a few young players there like Jed Ortmeyer and Ryan Hallwig, along with Matt Cullen and the Rangers PR guy John Rosasco, who was an important voice when it came to talking to the Rangers management. JR had a lot of influence on Glenn Sather, and he and Shanny were buddies. Shanny coached me with his eyes from across the table to make sure I said the right things. I would have said just about anything to stay in New York. The energy of the great city streets was exactly what I was craving. Initially, the glitter of Hollywood had attracted my attention, but now the bullshit scene of fake friends and what-can-you-do-for-me attitude was wearing thin. Now I wanted some of New York's grit. I wanted to walk down Broadway through the hordes of tourists and say that I lived here. Alicia is working 15-hour days, and I'm not seeing much of her. When you date someone who works and travels as hard as we do, you understand the sacrifice. We went to dinner once while I was there. I talked about how much I loved it here, and she listened. At no point did she say, "Well, that wouldn't be good for us." She was aspirational like me, and she said she'd love to work in New York and do a play on Broadway, but her schedule was locked for the next year. Mine as a pro athlete was not, and that I could be traded in the time it took to make a phone call. She definitely felt that it wouldn't be easy if I got traded to New York, because long distance is never easy. But we were both confident that if I did move east, we could make it work. We certainly wanted to make it work. I flew back to L.A. focused on playing well, and hoping that by doing that, I'd get the call to come to the center of the world and become a New York Ranger. It didn't take long. On February 5th, 2007, I'm in a Macy's department store in a mall in Tampa, Florida, with my mother and my grandmother, who lives 60 miles down the road in Sarasota. Mom has flown here from Toronto to spend some time with me because it's easier than getting out to Los Angeles, and maybe she's here because of Mother's intuition. Shanny has told me that he's had conversations with Glenn Sather about making the deal happen. Tomorrow we play Tampa Bay. But when I pack my bags for this road trip, I put a little extra gear into the mix. 2 extra suits, extra underwear, my lace-up boots, and my leather jacket, in case I was going somewhere colder. While we're hanging out in the mall, my cell phone rings, and on the other end of the line is Dean Lombardi. Usually this is the worst phone call a pro athlete can receive, because it means your life is about to be turned upside down, but I'm ready for it. We're programmed to say goodbye to our friends and teammates at the drop of a hat. It doesn't matter if you've been with them for 6 years or 2 weeks. You live always ready to be on the move. The news is always a blow, and you feel a surge of emotion at having to leave. But this time, the call is different. Dean comes straight to the point. He tells me that I've been traded to the New York Rangers, and he gives me Glenn Sather's phone number. He tells me that I have to get in touch with Slats to organize my trip to New York. My call with Glenn was like any other call you'd have with him, as I would learn. Direct, to the point, and quick. "We're happy to have you," he said. "Get here as soon as possible, mix things up, and get our guys going." My life path is about to change, and the disappointment that my mom and Nana feel about me having to fly to New York tonight turns into pleasure when they realize how happy I am. We take a taxi back to the hotel so I can get my bags and head to the airport. I kiss them goodbye and walk off to a new beginning as a Broadway blue shirt. Chapter 15. I look good in blue. When you start with a new team, there are so many moving parts that you usually don't remember much when the dust settles. But this time, I remember everything. My senses were on high alert, just as I imagined they would be when I pulled the Ranger jersey over my head for the first time. It felt like a second skin. The blue matches my eyes, and red is my favorite color. And the Rangers have restored the hockey cosmos to its proper order. They've given me number 16, the number I wore until I made the NHL. I take it as a sign that I'm in the right place. Seeing Shanahan in the dressing room feels good. This is the first time I've seen him since the trade, though he texted me once the deal was done to say, "Get ready." He's his usual suave self, as if this is just another day at the office, but I think I detect a wink. Seeing Jaromir Jagr there makes me kind of starstruck. He comes up to me and shakes my hand and says, "Nice to meet you." Before the trade, Jagr asked New York management why they needed to trade for me because he thought I was a goon. After our first game together, he said he wanted me on his line. The game is across the Hudson River in New Jersey, and I'm getting my first taste of how different road trips are when you play on the East Coast as opposed to the West. In New York, you can take the bus to games in New Jersey, Long Island, and Philadelphia, and everywhere else in the East is a short flight away. Even Florida. Playing on the East Coast can literally add years to a player's career. My first game was to be across the Hudson against the Devils in New Jersey. I was fired up the moment I hit the ice for our warm-up. A weird thing always happens in hockey when a new guy arrives with his new team. He scores a point in his first game. It happens so often that no one is surprised by it. Tom Rennie is our coach and he throws me out on the power play. And just like that, I have my first point as a Ranger. I get an assist 15 minutes into the first period, a little more than a minute after the Devils open the scoring. Game on. In the second period, a new game begins, one that will play out for my entire career as a Ranger. I snag a turnover at center and then turn up ice, stick-handling around a few Devils. I take D-man Colin White wide and make a nifty move to the inside, and it's now just me and the Devils' goalie, Mr. Martin Pierre Brodeur. I don't have much room after I beat White, and Marty plays it perfectly, like the Vezina Hart Stanley Cup-winning goalie he is, taking most of my angle away. I bury a shot in his chest and actually try to pull up before I get to him, but we both go down. We get to our feet, and Marty pushes me with both hands, and I remember thinking, this fucking guy. I actually tried to pull up, and I plow my stick into Marty's solar plexus. You might say that the Devils fans instantly saw me as public enemy number one, and one of the greatest New York Ranger feuds was born with our friends in the Meadowlands. The night was February 6, 2007, and my new mission, after taking Manhattan, was to find out every personal detail on Marty Brodeur that I could get for the next time we met. All I really knew about New York was that it was a place I wanted to live, but I had no idea where. The handful of players who stayed in Manhattan all lived on the Upper West Side because of the easy access to the West Side Highway, which was the route to the Rangers practice rink about an hour's drive north of the city near Tarrytown, New York, and where the team's owner, James Dolan, whose family used to own Cablevision, kept his fleet of airplanes and helicopters. Every NHL team has a guy that handles team travel, hotels, and meals on the road, as well as helping players find a place to hang their hat. In New York, Jason Vogel is the go-to guy for the Rangers and the Knicks, and he helped me with the hunt to find a furnished apartment to rent for the remainder of the season. Despite Jason's friendly warnings, I wound up choosing the worst place a person could live in New York City, Times Square. The place is a total assault on the senses, from the streets constantly jammed with people going to Broadway shows and the tourists getting their tongues sunburned from walking around with their mouths open in astonishment to the neon signs and video screens that light the place up like it's high noon when it's actually midnight. Even so, this choice was about me staying on theme, which was to absolutely immerse myself in New York City. What better place to live than the center of it all? So I moved into a furnished one-bedroom apartment 16 floors above the M&M store in Times Square. It was as far from LA as I could get. I didn't have a car in New York, so I relied on carpooling to practices with Jed Ortmeier and Ryan Hallweg. They were gritty, hard-nosed Rangers who were both good guys. Hallweg was a California kid who liked to party hard and to play video games and guitar in his spare time, but he worked his ass off at the rink. Ortmeier was from Omaha and had played for Red Berenson at the University of Michigan. He was a grinder as well, with the work ethic of a champion. He drove to the practice facility in Tarrytown in his black GMC Denali, and since both guys were usually as tired as I was from being out the night before, the ride wasn't exactly Fury Road. It was a very quiet 45-minute trip coming and going, because after practice, we all just wanted to get back home to go to sleep. On my fourth day living in Times Square, after treating myself to some local cuisine, my first New York pastrami sandwich from a classic New York deli, I was pickpocketed on my walk home. Welcome to New York. Once I'd recreated the contents of my wallet, which included a three-hour detour to the Department of Motor Vehicles, a true New York initiation, I purchased a new wallet that was attached to a chain, which clipped onto my belt loop. But I had to admit, I was starstruck. I even loved getting pickpocketed in this city. What I do not love is where things stand with me and Alicia. Not good in short. Alicia is great, and she's a Canadian girl, so she gets hockey. She understands the game and the players, and she knows that this is a big step up for me, and she couldn't be more supportive. But her life is in LA and mine is here, and from the moment I got to New York, it's been like being in a bullet train. Non-stop New York. I was totally focused on succeeding here. As much as I loved Alicia, I knew I wanted to stay in New York for the rest of my life. Alicia and I have about 2 months left in the tank at this point, and our phone calls become less frequent as we both stop sacrificing sleep to make up for the time difference between us. When we broke up, it was over the phone, and Alicia had contempt for me because she thought I was bailing on the relationship. And in truth, I was bailing before things got really bad between us. I needed to follow my New York dream, and Alicia needed her life in LA. Of course, karma would soon come back to punch me in the face. On February 9th, 2007, I made the 10-minute stroll from Times Square to the Garden to play my first game in Manhattan against the team I was supposed to play against when I got traded here, the Tampa Bay Lightning. I feel like it's the Stanley Cup final because I'm on top of the world. The old dressing room at MSG was so small and cramped that you could touch the ceiling. The trainer's room had three tables and a cold tub ice machine in the back. The guys who worked helping with laundry and hauling water bottles and moving sticks from the dressing room to the bench were real New Yorkers. These guys were Teamsters who also worked on movie sets in the city, and they talked with heavy accents like they were straight out of a Scorsese movie. Fuck you was a term of endearment from these guys. The hallways of MSG were lined with photos of the legendary performances the place had seen over the years. Zeppelin, The Stones, Aretha Franklin, Steve Martin, Sinatra, Messier in 1994, Joe Louis, George Harrison, Billy Joel 65 times. The 1976 Democratic Convention, the Jackson 5, WrestleMania, Ali versus Frazier, three times. The moment you walk into the Garden, a feeling starts to tingle in your veins, like the buzz of it is going to lift you up into the air. This is no longer a place where I come to play in once a year or every few years. This is now home. Holy shit, this is special. About halfway through the game, I take a Michael Nylander pass from the half boards. I take a single stride as my bottom hand slides up towards my top hand, and the flex in my Easton snaps the puck off my blade into the top corner past Johan Holmquist for my first goal as a New York Ranger. We're now up 4-0 on the Lightning, and the crowd starts the A-V-E-R-Y chant. MSG is chanting my fucking name. This is the big time. A week later in Carolina, we win 5-2. I get 2 assists on the power play, more than 16 minutes of ice time, and we've won 3 in a row. It's an away game,